I'm seeing all this go down on Twitter, and I was like, this is so silly. And I literally thought to myself, like, am I just getting older? I'm not old. I'm 38 years old. Like, in my mind, anyone below the
know. It might
60
be
isn't
a
old.
combination
And
because
even that.
when I remember when I met you, you used to engage more with those kind of people. You just liked it. Like you, it seems
Look,
like you enjoyed
I
the
come from a Jewish
confrontation.
background, of sorts. Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
Besides cold and receiving all the snow that I can't have?
I saw it was actually trending on Twitter because there were so many people outside going, "What the actual fuck?" I have lived in LA almost 20 years and never seen it snow in like this was in Burbank properly. I was standing in front of Porto's
Wow.
and there was snow landing everywhere.
Yeah, I've
And
seen
you know, it
videos
was
of people in Disney, but I haven't seen any here. So it's like pretty close to me, but I haven't noticed anything.
The crazy thing is that there was plenty of blue in the sky. Like it was it's just crazy. In almost 20 years of living here, not only have I never seen it snow, but I couldn't fathom that it wouldn't be under more harsh looking weather. It was absolutely surreal. I mean, it
Yeah.
felt cold,
It's pretty
but it
sunny
didn't
right
feel
now.
so cold.
Yeah. No, it is cold. It's sunny, but it's cold. But
I mean, it
yeah.
has to be below freezing for it to turn to snow. I mean, quite
True.
literally. So it didn't feel that cold. I mean, I remember that cold and my skin's gotten a lot thinner. I would have thought that I would be miserable because I was just out wearing my
Right.
normal sweatshirt. Went to go pick up some stuff at the store and was like, I remember I even messaged you. I said, Dan, it's surprisingly cold outside. And then before I know it was falling on me.
Aww.
Anyway, it's so cliche to fixate on the weather in Los Angeles, but
I
anyway,
mean, no,
yes.
it is pretty awesome. We live in a desert and it's snowing and that's amazing and I get it.
Quite rare. It's been, you know, as you go up the hills like Burbank, Altadena, and whatnot, where you get a little bit of altitude, it's like full on
White.
snow covered little mini mountains. It's
Let's
quite something.
go, let's go, let's go, let's go. I want to touch it.
Now let's go to real snow. This as
Oh
much as
my
this.
God.
As much as this.
I'm never. Look, if I die tomorrow, you'll be so sorry.
That's true. Won't really give a shit about the snow, but fact.
Yeah, well, I will make you remember that I will be so sad I never saw the snow in real life.
Well, you saw dusting in Washington, D.C. several years ago. That was snow.
Yeah.
That was more legit snow than what we have here, and that was not like snow.
Yeah. Anyway,
In any case, yeah.
welcome to another episode of Brushes and Keys. Today we're gonna talk about being old. You know why did I come up with this topic? Because it's March and I remember, oh my God, it's gonna be my birthday.
Yeah, as you hit mid-30s, so old.
Oh yes. So yeah.
The first thing I thought of is I do find myself having conversations that make me feel like old man yells at cloud for sure, because case in point, I am becoming that guy that feels increasingly at odds with some of the, shall we say, younger members of my profession.
Yep.
And I've gone out of my way from the earliest days where I felt like I had anything at all to offer in terms of advice or, you know, practical, you know, like tips or anything along those lines. You know, basically, I've always professionally tried to live as an open book. And if I did anything that struck anybody as remotely kind of worth asking about, like if a younger composer or an older composer, actually, for that matter, if anybody said, "Hey, how'd you do X or Y, or what made you decide to do this or that?" I was always all too happy to share in the hopes that they might find something useful that helps them in their own work. You know, I to me, that's the kind of industry I want to be part of. Well, what that means is that advice comes freely, and you know, in the same breath, I would also offer that talk is cheap, and what I mean by that is, if somebody offers advice, it costs them nothing to offer it, and it costs you nothing to accept or reject it. And that seems perfectly fair. But there was a little kerfuffle online I witnessed where somebody wrote on a forum, a young composer, how they were, you know, they're just getting started, they're early in their career, and they were offered like $700 to score a little short film. You know, I don't know, probably less than a 10-minute film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll tell you, first off, when I was first getting started, I did,
three jobs. Yes, that's how
I did probably excess of 90 short films for free.
Oh my God.
And when they, most were student films, so they didn't have any money. You know, they were, we were all paying for the privilege of making these because we were students.
Was this person complaining because of the money?
No, they weren't. They were, their story was how they managed to ask for almost double and they got it. And they were sharing how, you know, sometimes you just have to ask for it. And it's, sometimes you get lucky, and you know, they wrote a whole long post, and I don't need to summarize it, but the point being, they said this is like, you know, sometimes you win some, and they were sharing it as a story for fellow composers to read, and I thought, oh, that's great, it's true. Sometimes you can just ask for more, and you'll get it. It's a great lesson.
Actually, you know what? The parenthesis here, because I remember the first commission you asked me to do was something like that. There was some mix up with the price of something of a painting. And at the end, you paid a lower amount. It was like, I don't think this is what we agreed. And I felt so weird asking you for more money. I even talked to my mom. I even asked her. Yeah, I asked her.
I forgot all about that.
How do I ask him for more money? What do I do? And she's like, well, it's probably, misunderstanding. And it's okay, you can just mention it. And I was like, I don't know, maybe I should just keep my mouth shut if I want to keep this client. And at the end, I obviously asked for it because, I am a starving artist. I have no steady income, so that's a lesson. Like, yeah, whatever, you know, just ask for the value you feel that is right.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways one can conduct their business. And part of the creativity of being an entrepreneur is finding the thing that works best for you. And so some people would take your approach and say, well, look, I don't know when my next paycheck is going to be. So if this person offered to pay X and they came in under that number, or, you know, the work took twice as long as I thought it would, and I need to see if they're open to renegotiating, et cetera.
Right.
These are all things that, these are like levers you can pull to, you know, to your own personal comfort.
I didn't mean to interrupt. You can continue the story.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, like, to me, that lack of one size fits all, that lack of central set of protocol that everybody can run their business in a way that works for them, is the most fair and is the most sensible. Because, you know, if I have a really good year and then someone comes along with a project that I look at and I go, this is a dream project in every way except financial. They don't have any money, but I love everything about this. But I had a good year, so you know what? I'm going to do it for free. Or I'm going to do it for whatever, you know, if they have a tiny little bit of money or whatever the case. Like, I reserve the right to make that decision for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody else comes along and their advice is, under no circumstance should an artist of any kind sort of allow their work to be devalued, and therefore free work is just inherently bad and to be rejected at all times, they have every right to set that boundary for themselves. And maybe there's a circumstance that would bend that for them. Maybe there's a circumstance that wouldn't. You know, there's a big difference between Disney telling you we don't have any money and a student, you know what I mean?
Right.
So these are the kinds of things that I've always felt it important to navigate. And I'm 100% an advocate of not underselling yourself. Like, don't undervalue what you think it is that you have to offer. But also there's a big picture, and I'm a believer in that. And especially there's this idea of, there was a famous study years ago that is kind of summarized as like the marshmallow experiment, where they offered a bunch of kids We'll give you a marshmallow now or two tomorrow, something like that. I'm paraphrasing it badly. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact parameters of the experiment, but it was something along those lines. And then they basically tracked those kids for years. And the ones that sort of did better in school and in life almost, you know, overwhelmingly correlated to those who were willing to delay gratification and say, you know what, I won't take a marshmallow today, but I'll take two tomorrow. That's a fair trade. Like, that's right. A better deal.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense. You know, if you're willing to kind of, it's why people, you know, tend to build up savings accounts, tend to be more comfortable later in life. Of course, obviously, that's a tautology. It's an obvious statement. But it applies to a lot of things, and especially to the entrepreneur, somebody that's willing to kind of take it on the chin today as an investment in the future. I think that that makes a lot of sense as a predictor of long-term success. It's the exact same thing as the marshmallow. So in that vein, composer, friend, colleague of mine, guy named Jeff Zanelli, he's done a bunch of movies, done some games. Actually, I think he's only worked on one game, but he wanted after Hans Zimmer quit scoring the Pirates of the Caribbean films, he was the one who did the next one. So he's one of Hans's proteges, and he's achieved some real major success.
That's cool.
And in my experience, he's always been a very nice guy. So in response to this person saying, hey, I managed to get double the budget, he put out his own thoughts and he said, for what it's worth, I don't know that was the right move here. Even though you got more money in the short term, there are other factors to think about in terms of the long term. In right. particular, the argument that he made that I don't actually know that I agree with, but it was interesting to think about, was if you go in and you're being very negotiating, and you say, I think I'm worth double, will you give it? And the person says, you know what, I'll figure out a way to pay you double. Sure. He goes, they don't think of you now as an artist. They think of you as like this business, almost right. like they think of you more like an agent.
That was my fear with you. I got lucky because you are very understanding, and sometimes you're too nice. But
it's actually not that at all. It's not that I'm understanding. To me, business and art need not be thought of as separate lanes. I admire savvy business people who happen to be artists. You know, like as much as Hans Zimmer is polarizing, he has found a way to commoditize music on a way that's on a level that is unprecedented. I mean, he has built a brand that is so gigantic that you can't, if you have any interest in entrepreneurship, you can't not admire the hell out of the guy. You don't have to like his music. You know, there's a lot of, you know, backroom whispers about the way the business is run. And set all that aside, he has managed to build something that is impressive on its face, if nothing else. I personally have no bad experiences, directly, personally with him. And I don't like to judge people based on the hearsay of others. So all that said, yeah, Jeff just put out what I thought was food for thought. I look at it and I go, yeah, that's an interesting idea. Like, is it worth not negotiating until you can have an agent or somebody who does that for you? And they get to be the representative of the business and you get to be the artist. That was his general argument. I, as someone who's very passionate about the business side, you know, I like having an agent, but I also, if I had to represent myself, I would actually enjoy it because I like that side. I like the business. I like spreadsheets and budgets and all that stuff. So all that said, people on Twitter got quite upset with him for offering bad advice. And they were like, you have a responsibility to give good advice to young composers. And I just remember thinking, I must be getting old because that's such bullshit.
Well, for this shit.
I'm sorry, but I think it's bullshit. I think if someone doesn't like his advice, don't follow it.
Right.
Do your own thing.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why that became so hard. Like, I didn't even fully agree with his advice, but I found it interesting to think about. Right. And then mm-hmm. I moved on with my life. Exactly. And he's a nice guy, and the world kept spinning. Like, also, he only put that out there in the hopes that it might be helpful to somebody. And the mm-hmm. idea that that's inherently bad. So mm-hmm. it was one of those where, you know, the people that were complaining, look, I like them too. I got no qualms with them. I saw somebody tweet and I wrote, what is this about? And they were like, oh, I just keep seeing really bad advice being given to young composers. Because they wrote something like, how about, as a rule, we don't give advice anymore or something like that.
Oh my God, okay.
And I said, well, for what it's worth, I give advice all the time, but only because people ask me for advice. And
right.
And I think that's very touching that anybody would even care for what I think. And so I give it. But if I give, if a young composer says, what should I do in this situation? I'll say, well, look, you should listen to your conscience. Here's what I would do, or here's some things to think about. But in the end, you're going to do what you think is right, and that is the ultimate best choice.
Yeah.
So I could offer horrible advice, but it's still up to them to decide to follow it. You know, I've taken bad advice before. I've done things that I you know, in later realized, oh, that person didn't really know what they were talking about, but I took their advice anyway. Like, that's my own learning process. You know, it's not like someone's advising you to jump off a bridge. So I found myself going, am I old? is this what happens, that I find myself just baffled at the at this idea that anybody who is older than a college graduate, a fresh college graduate or something, has a responsibility to only offer. How do you even measure that? What is the good advice? Is it advice they agree with? Is that, how do we even determine what's, or just don't offer advice, make it a soulless
communityless? I started to notice my interactions in social media as well. Like, I probably give less fucks arguments in general of anything, you know, AI, art, or I don't know. Everybody's fighting about something.
I'm coming for you on that one.
Everybody fighting about something in particular, something specific, and I'm like, I care about this topic. I have my own opinion about that, but I'm not gonna just put myself in a compromise, because it doesn't matter which side you are, you're always gonna be attacked. This is how I see things now. I don't know if it's because everybody's changing, or I don't know. It's so weird. That kind of thing made me feel like maybe I'm just too old. Maybe I just can't handle this shit anymore. Maybe I should.
It could be. It's like that South Park episode where Stan just suddenly starts thinking everything sounds like shit, like literal actual shitting. And it was actually genius and kind of sad episode where they're like, you know, sometimes you just reach an age where you're not impressed by things. To be clear, I'm not that way. Like, I get excited when a new game comes out. I get excited when a new album comes out. When a friend of mine, you know, wins an award or lands a great job, like, it's not acting when I go and I, you know, send them.
That's very sweet of you. I've seen that all the time, and I don't know.
It's not me trying to be sweet. I genuinely think it's cool. I like to kind of acknowledge things that excite me and I think are cool. And I also, the reason why I find this stuff frustrating is because I really like helping other composers. I really like being there for them. When I first moved to LA, a few composers were really gracious to me, and it made such a difference to feel welcome to this new home that I had the stupidity and craziness to want to move to, not knowing a single person. I did not know one person in Los Angeles. And within a week, a composer named Jim Dooley and a composer named Nate Barr, both who didn't know me from anybody, kind of opened their doors to me and made me feel very at home. And they were like, you know, you're part of the crowd now. All you had to do was move. And that was 20 years ago. Now, you don't even really have to move. Like, if some composer reaches out to me and they're like, hey, I live in, you know, Edinburgh, or I live in Cairo, or I live in Tokyo, or I live in wherever. In my mind, they're just as much part of the composer community just by virtue of announcing that they are. Like, there's no barrier to entry, but people think there is. And so I like to be just one voice in the crowd that says, hey, if you think you belong here, as far as I could tell, you belong here. Now, everybody's going to have different amounts of career success and different levels of talent and la-da-la-da, and I'm not the type to say, just by virtue of wanting to be a composer, you're automatically destined to be the next Hans Zimmer or John Williams or Jerry Goldsmith. But you are welcome a seat at the table to give it a shot, and that it's up to you to keep trying and make every day a good day to die. No, Klingon quote. Make it another day up at bat, and you know, to do your best and try again, and that's the best we can do. So it's like, it's frustrating when, you know, I don't mean to sound self-aggrandizing, but I put a lot of time that I don't have to try to help fellow composers. That's why I do the Game Maker Notebook podcast, right. And it's why I do things like the Gang Scholars program, where I'll mentor composers one-on-one at GDC or at Game Sound Con.
Even though your YouTube is full of that stuff.
YouTube channel is almost entirely, like, it's fun, and I like sharing process, and I like sharing interviews and things, but obviously, yeah, the main demographic of the audience is probably young composers, and it's fun, and I enjoy, and when students message and they're like, you have no idea how much time I've spent going through your channel and whatever, like, it makes it worth it. I feel like a single one of those emails makes me go, oh, okay, well, good, that's worth the 300 hours it took to make that video. Because it's really gratifying to feel like, you know, the way I was raised is like, if you go into a place, you know, leave it better than you found it. You know, it's like, even like as a kid, I would notice when we would go to a restaurant, my dad in particular, my parents are both very neat, but I remember my dad, he would always like fold his napkin, put everything back. Now, part of it is, I think, just his OCD. But some people go to a restaurant and they think, oh, what's it matter to clean up? Like, there's other people whose job that is. And it's like, yeah, but you can make their job easier. And it doesn't take much effort if you're sitting there. I would always notice my dad would sweep the crumbs into his napkin and then fold up the napkin and whatever. So it was like, I don't think he did it thinking I'm like,
right,
I'm so awesome, like Jerry Seinfeld congratulating himself on the guy's Pakistani restaurant on Babu. I don't think he's doing that. I think it was just an instinct. And you learn that as a kid, like, oh, that's nice. Yeah, I like the idea of you leave it better than you found it. And so it strikes me as odd that any version of behavior like that could be somehow seen as toxic. Like, it's not, yes, of course, if you package your advice as, if you don't do this, you're probably asking for trouble. Like, of course, anybody who frames it like that, and especially if they're, you know, in a position of authority, a young, naive composer might look at that and go, oh, I guess I better do that. But even then, first off, you're going to get disabused of your naivete at some point, and maybe that's it. We all have our innocence lost moment where we realize, oh, shit, my parents don't know everything. Adults don't know it. Politicians don't know everything. Most adults don't know any more than I do, like, if not less, like, depending on your specialization or whatever. Like, we all have that moment. So on the one hand, maybe if you mindlessly follow a senior level composer's advice and then it bites you in the ass, now that's your moment. That's your rite of passage going, I guess now I'm not as innocent, but I've learned. The point being, however you learn it, maybe don't just automatically follow advice, period. Like, I thought that was obvious. I thought that was baked in. You shouldn't need to feel hesitant to offer advice because other people shouldn't just feel like they're obligated to do what you say. No one has to take a single word of advice I ever offer. But again, I thought all of that was understood. I thought all of that was very obvious. As soon as you, it's so funny because I'm seeing all this go down on Twitter and I was like, this is so silly. And I literally thought to myself, like, am I just getting older? I'm not old. I'm 38 years old. Like, in my mind, anyone below the 60 isn't old.
It might be a combination.
Old.
Because and even that. I remember when I met you, you used to engage more with those kind of people. You just liked it. Like, you, it seems
look,
like
I
you
come,
enjoyed the
I come from a Jewish background of sorts. And arguing at the dinner table is a time honor. That's such a Jewish thing. I don't consider myself Jewish, but it is kind of in my lineage, and that is a classic trait.
So
like a minute ago you said, you know, it doesn't matter which side you're on. Even that pings for me because the way I like to think of things, at best, a side is like one of those D&D, you know, D20 dies where there's not even left and right or up and down or black and white. It's like there's 1,000 nuanced perspectives. And if you take that to its logical conclusion, what you end up realizing is it's hard to categorize things in broad groups. It really just comes down to the individual. And I'm a believer in, you know, individual perspective, which is why I'll listen to just about any opinion, you know, because I leave it up to my own filter on if I'm going to follow it or if I glean something of value. But I'll listen to just about anything. And I like argument. I like wrestling with difficult subjects. I like being proven wrong. Mm-hmm. There are fewer thrills in life. As I like to quote, I believe it was Lawrence Krauss who I first heard say this, the astrophysicist, he's not an astrophysicist, he's a theoretical physicist. He once said something like, to the effect of, being proven wrong is one of the greatest feelings in the world, contrary to what most people think, because when you realize it's wrong, you are no longer wrong. Mm-hmm. That's the point. It's mm-hmm. the feeling of now being maybe not right, but less wrong.
Yeah, and but there's something, great. I know, I get it, but there's something that you have to understand, and it's the environment you are getting involved in.
Well, and yeah, that's why I don't do this shit online anymore. This is why I don't...
Thank
yeah.
you. And I take pride on being one of... I don't know if there was more people telling you, you shouldn't do that, but I remember when I met you, you were into that kind of thing, and I remember a few times asking you, maybe you shouldn't waste time on the internet that much doing that. So I take pride on that. I think I deserve some recognition behavior today.
Yeah, you may have spared me massive public cancellation because there's no subject that I don't consider. Like I will debate, or I'll listen to debate on just about everything that you can think of. You know, like, and I like watching people. Like, there's some real courageous things you can find online. I like watching debates about, you know, fraught subjects. Like, you know, Christopher Hitchens and Stephen Fry arguing with a pair of Catholics on the proposition the Catholic Church is a force for good in the world, yes or no? And they argued vehemently, no, the Catholic Church is a poisonous force in this world. Well, you can imagine there were hundreds of people in the audience that found even just the idea of thinking that offensive. You know, like a devout Catholic hearing that and saying, you know, something so interwoven with my identity, you would dare to call it a poison on this planet? And then they spend an hour offering why they think that. And, you know, maybe the ardent Catholics walk away completely unchanged in their opinion. And maybe there's someone in the middle who goes, I found that convincing. And then maybe there's people on the other side who walked into the debate going, I'm pretty anti-Catholic. And then they heard the arguments from the Catholic opposition and they went, actually, you know what? I'm now pro-Catholic. Like, that's how it's supposed to be. These arguments let people wrestle with things that are tricky. And I don't mind that. I don't mind. I shouldn't even say I don't mind. I enjoy difficult topics mm-hmm. because life is messy.
Right.
And there is no obvious answer to most interesting questions.
I think it's a combination of social pressure, of course, and the ego. Like, people don't like to be told they're wrong.
Yeah, plus there's such tribal polarization that if there's a perception that you're on the other team, and both teams, both
right.
major like political ideologies in the U.S. are pretty guilty of, once they kind of see you on one side, they'll attribute every position that side has supposedly to you, which means that people are constantly pushed away from the center, basically. And that's not good for debate. Like I've seen so many times where I'll see pretty nasty comments online from people where I agree with them. I agree with everything that they're saying, but how they're saying it is so uncharitable mm-hmm. that I'm like, who are you convincing this way? It's disappointing.
Well, I guess, yeah, most of them don't have the mindset, the debate mindset. Just put their thoughts and that's it, and they don't like to be told it's probably not as they say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame because it's hard to learn if you're not willing to be proven wrong, if you're not willing to be shown, hey, this is not correct, but let me show you why. Like, there needs to be a compassion in that.
Yeah. I'm mostly just watching from the fence because I'm tired.
Well, look, there's been 1,000 podcasts talking about the difficulties that social media pose to discourse. We don't need to. I don't have anything fresh to offer on that perspective. I don't have a fresh perspective to offer on that topic. The paper trail of past tweets where we might have said things that we no longer agree with, now being used as a cudgel, for example, bring somebody down. Like, I see my Facebook memories. I used to write the dumbest shit on Facebook. and not that it was offensive. It was usually just super lame. It was just like, today I was busy. Great. Good for you.
We evolve. This is part of it.
You're wiser
now. That's good.
Yeah, I definitely use it all a lot less. But it's a shame because there is this optimistic side to me that says this tool, this idea of everyone in the world being able to have a conversation with everyone else in the world, that should bring us closer.
Yeah.
Like, by all rights, that seemingly should make us more excited to engage, because now I don't have to worry about, is this a progressive perspective versus a conservative perspective? Now I should theoretically be able to have tens of thousands of very individual perspectives. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating to me that it seems to have the exact opposite effect. I don't understand that, because I want high resolution images, not low resolution, not just like this side versus that side, but a million individual people who go, look, I agree with 70% of what you said, but here's 30% where I think you're wrong. Hear me out on this. Like, you'd think it would be more of that.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I'm probably, as much as this is all about getting older, maybe I'm also naive that I don't understand why it.
Social media has backfired. I think just in general, the people that are more involved in that kind of discussions, it's because they have more free time. I guess they enjoy I don't feel attracted to that, just for mental health, just for my sanity, but also I think it's all about growing up and feeling just wiser and feeling maybe this, I'm not getting anything from this. I'm never gonna see this person in my life. Like, I should just let them think whatever they want, because it seems like they are not gonna change their mind. And it doesn't matter how much I try to tell them, maybe it's not like that. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think the whole idea of arguing in good faith is very important. And to me, the essence of what that means is I am willing to change my mind, and I'm assuming you are too.
Yeah. But not everybody has that.
No, in fact, it seems that it's quite rare.
Yeah.
Which always surprised me.
Yeah, I gotta be careful. Even with people we know, we have to be careful. It's insane. I sometimes feel I can't be 100% myself and social, activities or whatever, because I feel like if I joke about something, somebody might feel attacked. I don't know.
Yeah, no, and obviously anyone who knows you knows that you would never actually want to make someone feel bad or feel attacked or anything like that. But, we're both pretty sarcastic and the irreverent. I've certainly had those moments of feeling like, yeah, I guess I'm going to keep my mouth shut. Just because I'm not interested in opening a can of worms.
Right.
Because the other thing is, I will acknowledge this is probably not my best trait, but I enjoy being devil's advocate because I learn. So if somebody says, I believe that, all drugs should be legal. Like, I'm for total legalization of all narcotics, drugs, everything. I largely agree. Like, I'm actually pretty against how criminalized drugs are and how unequally those laws are applied. Like, I'm a big fan of of getting rid of those laws, you know, making not just pot legal, but most drugs, I think, there's a strong case to be made for legalization. Now, there's also strong cases to be made why that's wrong. And I find it fascinating. So somebody might go, I am for total legalization of everything, all the way up to heroin and beyond. And my instinct is to go devil's advocate just to learn why they think that and go, well, what do you have to say when somebody points out that, you know, chronic addiction is like a mental health crisis and that the state is powerless to help somebody unless we can say that what they're doing is illegal? Like, that's, what if we made that argument? And I want to learn how they push back against that, because we're probably operating from the same place, but I find it a fascinating thing rather than to just say, I like to have, it's like Socratic. I like to have an actual discussion. And so I routinely, when someone makes a big claim, oh, I think this, I think that, even when I agree, especially when I agree, I like to play the part of the other side in order to just kind of explore how they've got to their conclusion. Because even when we agree, they sometimes might have better arguments than I do, or they might have come at it from a different angle. They've undoubtedly come at it from a different angle. I like that. Well, the risk with social media especially is as soon as you do that, all that exists is a tweet of you arguing the thing that you don't actually believe. And so it's like, and then now that thing will haunt you for eternity. Screenshots and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to be careful because I learn a lot from that. And anybody who ever does that with me in person, I think it's pretty clear that we're just talking. We're not, it's usually over a drink or over a meal or what, like, there's no malice behind that. My goal is to learn, to be a better person.
Yeah.
But boy, is it easy to get the wrong impression.
True.
And you have to be careful. And I find myself biting my tongue because I think, the odds of this backfiring, even though I really do believe I have only good intention, the odds of this backfiring means I probably should just let the moment pass.
Yeah.
But that feels like a shame. That does feel a little bit like maybe I'm getting too old for this shit.
And
that's sad.
It's sad, but it's worth it, you know?
You are right. If I'm at a crossroad in a given moment where I go, I can spend 10 minutes embroiled in conversation with this person in which the odds are very likely that neither of us will change our mind about anything, or I can spend that 10 minutes writing music that hopefully in its own way somehow adds to the world and makes the world a better place. I think I've mentioned here before, I certainly have talked about it with you when I went to that concert Bob Townsend put together years ago in honor of the famous artist Drew Struzan, he just said, I just try to make the world a better place. I made all these posters and my art hoping it might make the world a better place. That's it. You know, he's like one of the most celebrated Hollywood poster artists of all time. And he had such simple motivation and I found it so moving. And I thought, you know, I'm down with that. If I have to use limited bandwidth and limited hours and limited time on this earth, probably best focusing on something that, you know, might improve someone's day or might make a game a better experience or a movie a better experience or a concert a better experience, and just leave it at that. Maybe that is my sign of aging, because when you're young, you think, okay, I'm going to do that and I'm going to change the world philosophically. And I think perhaps I don't have ambitions for that at this stage.
Yeah. I love that we put this topic because we feel old, but I bet some of our listeners are older and they're like, what the hell are you talking about?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think either of us are old. I mean, there are people who are 30 years older than me who I don't consider old. Old is one of those very relativistic, you're kind of as old as you act.
It's true. That's true.
But I do find myself thinking about things differently at 38 than I did at 28 or 18.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Which, of course, it'd be suspect if you didn't.
Right.
In any case, what is your album of the day? That is my thought on...
Yeah, well, this is a...
Old.
Yeah, interesting.
Cat Stevens' Wild World.
Well, that one's good though. But just to stick with the topic, because that's how I am. I was trying to think on artists that started their career late in life. So the album of the day today is going to be Andrea Bocelli's Il Mare Calmo della Sera, his debut album. He was in his mid-30s, kind of like us right now. And that was his first album.
Yeah, that looks correct. Born 1958. I didn't know that. That's definitely not so common for singers.
Mm-hmm.
One of my professors, Morten Lauritsen, the piece that made him famous, the Omanu Mysterium, he wrote after the age of 50. And then it instantly put him into being one of the most in-demand and respected composers in the U.S. For the second half of his life, basically. Life can be very unexpected and mysterious in that way. I mean, John Williams didn't score Star Wars until he was, I think, 43, 44.
That's crazy. You know who was also 40 when they started? Pharrell Williams.
How old is he now?
I don't know.
Is he like 50 now? 49. He's older than I thought.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like, but he was 40.
He's got such a young face. That's crazy.
That was when he launched his Happy Song. He was 40 when that happened.
Well, okay, but he was pretty well known before that.
He was a producer. He didn't sing. He was in the industry, but like behind the scenes. And then he started singing at the age of 40, if I'm not mistaken.
This I just don't know. But I do believe that you're right. He probably was operating behind the scenes before coming forward. Kind of like Sia is a good example of somebody who had written a bunch of hit songs for other artists before deciding to become their own.
Right.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, here, that's here, good here. Trivia.
Long before collaborating on Blur Lines with Robin Thicke, Pharrell made it as a producer before he started singing, with industry success coming by the age of 28. However, he didn't record his vocals till much later, launching his hit song Happy when he was 40.
I learned something.
There you go. It's never too late.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, you know, it might be too late if at age 60 you want to try to enter the Olympics. But in art is fortunately one of the most forgiving.
Yeah.
With the passage of time. It's not totally forgiving, particularly if you want to be a performer. But Leonard Cohen is another example. I think Troy and I talked about Leonard Cohen on You Gotta Hear This, about how he started quite late in life. Or was that here? I can't remember. I remember talking about him recently, but I don't remember what the context was. But he was somebody who wrote, you know, he was like a poet. He was essentially like a sort of struggling writer, and then decided, oh, I'll try writing some songs, and then became this huge, as like a career change. He became a major songwriter and performer and singer. So cool. There is no such thing as getting too old.
Only for argue with strangers on the internet.
But yeah, I am too old to bother with Twitter.
Do you want to argue about something important? I think the Phantom Menace is better than the Return of the Jedi.
Better than Return of the Jedi? That's an interesting matchup. There's probably some folks that would agree with you.
Oh my.
Mostly children, but
I don't even know what I'm talking about, so let's leave this topic here. Look, yeah, I know that we've seen them many times. All of them are mixed in my head, so I don't know which one is.
Oh my lord, that's the most controversial thing you've said today. All right.
Yeah, I'm gonna go bad. I don't care about that. Anyway, thank you all for being here and listening to our podcast, and don't forget, you can talk to us on social media, on Twitter and Instagram at Brushes and Keys. Thank you, bye.
Bye.